chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you say it coming, no time to play out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Rest make dab in the middle of it. Rest make dab in the middle. We are rest make dab.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. We've got a lot going on today. We've had just recent reports of not only Russian diplomatic personnel and families leaving Ukraine, but also the State Department has started an exodus, evacuation of American personnel and non-essential personnel from their consulates and their embassy in Ukraine. We have other evidence that I'm going to be talking about later about different radical groups that may be operating on like ISIS groups on the Ukrainian side. And then there's this Wayne group on the Donbass side that we don't know if there's any in there yet. But anyway, we're going to start off with Alex. And Alex is going to be talking about the world leaders, the dominant elites, changing from this COVID into some kind of a climate change. And right now, these world leaders have just concluded their meeting in Davos, Switzerland. It's the World Economic Forum annual meeting, and they just concluded that yesterday on the 27th. And I'm going to be playing a clip that has Bill Gates in there and some comments he makes about why would anyone want to purchase jet fuel at twice the price. They're putting forward these ecological green schemes, and they don't make sense and economically or in any other way. But anyway, we're going to start off with Alex stating that this is what he sees going on is a change from COVID to this climate change lockdown type of scenario. Here we go with Alex, and then we're going to follow that with Mark Levine talking about January 6th. And then Roger Stone follows that on his view of what happened up there also. So here we go with Alex.
The fact that the ruling class of the planet, the globalists, the Bilderberg group, the guys that run the Davos group, now said, okay, let's put the brakes on the COVID power grab. We've gone as far as we can go right now. This won't be like the limited pullbacks that you saw in the last 2 years off and on. This is going to be a major pullback. But they're going to let their own neurotics and their own minions and their own mayors and their own local leaders still continue to tyrannically enforce the garbage. But because we've been taking city councils back and taking local governments back, this is because it's gotten the grassroots angry to take back peacefully the school boards and the infrastructure, they've gone, whoa, in just a year and a half, the patriots are taking back as much as George Soros has financed with stolen money, over $10 billion the last decade. So their games, taking over local cities and towns, in a year and a half of people finally waking up, has been pushed back. And it's the same thing in Europe. People are waking up and all over. And Brazil and other areas of South America. And Central America is waking up. And Africa is waking up. And Asia is waking up. And the Middle East is waking up to the real globalist attack. But if you don't know about the globalist attack, you don't have a hope. So it's a big deal that they've now pivoted, as they said they would do in their white papers. I told you 22 months ago, I said, when they've pushed as far as they can push, they'll then move it to carbon taxes, social credit scores, and carbon lockdowns. And exactly that happened. And again, I will show you the magic trick. It's no trick at all. They write white papers. They write their policy papers. And that is a policy point that you see everywhere. They don't put these policy points in there because they like to write stuff for no reason.
Yes, they just concluded. He had some very good points, Alex did. They've just concluded their meeting at Davos, Switzerland, annual meeting of the World Economic Forum. I've tried to get over there several times, but I can't They won't let me in. I wonder why. But anyway, coming up next is Gates. Bill Gates was over there on a panel discussion, and he has some things to say about these alternative fuels and how, well, who's going to buy jet fuel at twice the price, he says. I mean, this stuff just does not make sense. And what they're doing is marshaling, you go through acquiescence of these corporations, this new so-called plan, this new reset, this new stockholder, stakeholder, I think they call it capitalism, or imagine a new form of capitalism is the way that they're talking over there. But anyway, here we go with Bill Gates and what he said on this committee. I'm going to be putting click-offs on thesecrettruth.com, and you can go in there and you can listen to this whole panel discussion. But first, this is just an excerpt from that panel discussion with Bill Gates speaking.
Well, the rich countries have to play a central role, both funding R&D and having policies, in some cases carbon taxes will be used, to drive the demand for these clean products. And only by doing that in an aggressive way will the economic costs be brought down enough that we can turn to all the middle-income countries and say, okay, you know, change your whole cement industry, change your whole steel industry, and yet, you know, it's not holding you back from, you know, your economic growth. The number of companies working on these things is very exciting. And some of them will fail. A lot of them will fail. But, you know, we only need a reasonable number, a few dozen of them, to make it through. And that's what we have to accelerate. In the power generation area, reliability is very important. When you have a heat wave or a cold snap, you know, when there's a typhoon in Japan, you know, you still want electricity. And so it's a little more complicated in that case than just the cost of renewables. That's super enabling. It's fantastic. But, you know, we need to model out those grids because reliability will be super important. So that area still needs work, just like, you know, many of the tough areas, particularly industrial processes. But, you know, human ingenuity is great. If we create the right incentive system, you know, get the private sector companies engaged in this in a deep way, that's, you know, that's what the solution looks like. One of the hardest things mankind has ever done, but worth doing.
And I guess since putting a price on carbon is quite controversial, even if it's, you can argue it's common sense, it's not as common in this context. I also then think that this First Movers Coalition, if we can mobilize the purchasing power of the really big players in the world, like we started with the First Movers Coalition in Glasgow, how can you see this develop? Can we see a snowball effect here?
Well, a lot of these products with very high green premiums, you have a how do you get started problem. You know, who's going to buy aviation fuel that's twice as expensive? Well, the answer is that, you know, rich country governments with carbon taxes and rich companies with their social commitments can bootstrap those markets. And, you know, so when it's modest volume, that will drive it forward, and that modest volume is what will drive the innovation so that we can see the price reductions. As you said, in some areas that's happened, in some other areas it's been harder. But that purchasing power is part of how we avoid the dilemma that there's no market for things with high green premiums.
Well, I believe he's right. There is no market for high premium, green premiums for products, because if you're running a corporation, even the ones owned by the elites and dominated by the corporate, and you're trying to get some passengers down to Australia, you're not going to pay twice the fuel cost to get down there. You're out of business. Like you said, there will be a lot of companies that will fail. this green thing is not economically feasible. There's no way about it. And this carbon tax, those are scams. Those are scams from the very beginning. Now we're going to move on to Mark Levine and what he had to say about January 6th. And he says some very, very powerful things. And boy, listen close to this guy. This guy has it down good. And then we're going to play a clip by Roger Stone about the speeches he made up on the 5th of January, and when he left was he never went and participated in any kind of insurrection or anything else. But here we go, leading off with Mark Levine, and I'll make a few comments before we play the Roger Stone clip.
That's what took place, the effort to overthrow an elected president of the United States, first to deny his election in 2016. They went to the floor. They challenged the electoral votes that had been cast, including from Alabama, for God's sakes. They had no problem with it. And by the way, they challenged the 2000 election, saying George W. Bush was an illegitimate president, that he was appointed by the Supreme Court of the United States. They said the 2004 election was illegitimate. John Kerry, that he really won. It was 70 or 80,000 votes total, but for the corrupt electoral college, he would be president of the United States. We're going to be lectured by these people who are liars, who push Russia collusion for years, who drag this country through the dirt, who are awarding themselves Pulitzer Prizes for lying to the American people. We're going to be lectured by the pages of the New York Times, whose correspondent in Moscow was a Stalin flunky in 1932 and covered up the slaughter of the Ukrainians, who had another leading reporter and correspondent in Berlin during the Holocaust, a Hitler flunky. The guy actually supported the Third Reich and they covered up the Holocaust. The New York Times, who sent a reporter to Cuba who comes back praising Castro. Now, I think a lot more damage has been done by the New York Times to this country than was done on January 6th. So let's talk about attacks on our democracy. 1954, Puerto Rican nationalists, they didn't just send people in to breach the Capitol. Four of them sat in the House gallery, shot five members of the House of Representatives. One was critically wounded. He survived. Shot five members of the House of Representatives. Every single one of them was pardoned by Jimmy Carter later. Every single one of them. 1971, the Weather Underground, the group that Bill Ayers belonged to, Bernie Dorn belonged to, pals, close associates, political allies of Barack Obama. What did they do? They blew up a room in the Capitol building, and they went back in 1983 and gave it another try. What else did the Weather Underground do? Set off a bomb at the Pentagon, set off a bomb at the State Department. Now, that's an insurrection, but they didn't call it an insurrection then. The people who breached the Capitol, broke the windows and the doors and attacked police officers, should be prosecuted. We conservatives and constitutionalists are consistent about that. The people who were on the Capitol lawn, or people who were waved into the building, or charged with parading on public property without a license or permission, who didn't do anything, that's an example of an insurrection, a president leading an insurrection, even though he's the one who said, if you need the National Guard, I'm happy to provide them to you. Dereliction of duty? That would be Nancy Pelosi. There's a massive cover-up now to protect Nancy Pelosi. If you care about what happened on January 6th, you should care to know what Nancy Pelosi knew. And if you care about justice and the Bill of Rights in this country, you should wonder why hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of American citizens who were not even in that building, some of whom are serving in jail right now, why they've been prosecuted for crimes like trespassing and parading on public property, and how that's an insurrection. The only person killed on that day was a protester, was a veteran who served in the United States Air Force. She didn't have a weapon. She didn't touch a soul. She walked into the building. She was climbing through a broken window, and she was shot dead.
Next is Roger Stone's clip about his speeches that he gave. I think he gave some speeches on the 5th. Of January, and then the next day, he decided the Secret Service had come by to escort him down to the Capitol. He said, there's something wrong here. He just decided to leave Washington, D.C. right then, and that's what he did. But here we go with what Roger Stone had to say about January 6th.
And you probably want to correct the record. Didn't you give two speeches on January 5th, and then no speeches on the 6th, or maybe you did. I just remember we couldn't get through the crowd. There was a million people outside the hotel. It took me almost an hour or more to get there through the crowd. It was hellish. And you just said, screw this, it's not safe, I'm staying back. That's what I remember our conversation was. And then the Secret Service came to get you to take us to the Capitol just like they did me. And you've got photos, by the way, that you're saying you're going to release in court now of those Secret Service because you wanted proof indeed it was them because you knew Secret Service doesn't do that type of thing. So for the record, tell folks what really happened on January 6th.
It'd be very hard for me to say because, of course, I wasn't on the Ellipse, did not march.
No, I meant with you. You were just, yeah.
I spoke at two legally permitted events on the 5th. One at the Supreme Court building, in front of the Supreme Court building, sponsored by Virginia Women for Trump. It was a legally permitted event. You can see video of my comments. At no time did I call for lawlessness or violence or anything of the kind. I did call for a 10-day delay in the voting of the electoral votes. Listen carefully, Democrats. That's called constitutionally protected free speech. That's political activity. The right to assemble is also guaranteed by the Constitution. We have an absolute right to question the results of the election. It's constitutionally protected free speech. I spoke that evening at Freedom Plaza to an enormous crowd. I know you spoke that night as well. I posted that speech at YouTube. YouTube has now chosen to remove that speech from my YouTube feed. Why? I have other copies of it. It proves that at no time did I make any inappropriate remark calling for violence or insurrection or...
And by the way, let me just add, they're pulling my speech at the Capitol trying to stop the violence everywhere because they don't want the truth out there.
It is absolutely true. As far as January 6th is concerned, I went out in front of my hotel, still on the hotel grounds in the morning. The vermin at ABC News... These people are not journalists. They are the lowliest propagandists I've met in 40 years in American politics. Use the technique of guilt by association. Oh, Stone was identified by this with this man who was later arrested for trespassing. Hey, ABC, that proves nothing. You're getting sued, too. Get online. But beyond that, I returned to my hotel room. And I was there for the rest of the day until I left at around 4 o'clock. If there was a war room in the Willard Hotel, I am unaware of it. I was in my room. I was in a room that you were using as a studio where I came by to just shake hands and meet General Flynn. And we had a brief but social conversation. No, we didn't discuss any illegal activities at the Capitol planned for the next day. And I was in the lobby. Those are the only rooms that I was in. So journalists, write that Roger Stone was in a war room in the Willard, and you're going to get slapped with a defamation suit very quickly.
And let's go forward with this. Bannon calls his show The War Room, named after your previous show here with Owen. And he had a show called War Room. You and Bannon are not buddies. And I see all over the news that, oh, Stone was in a war room plotting with Bannon. They don't even check basic facts. It's like saying Batman and the Joker are hanging out.
Yeah, look, I wouldn't be in the same room with Steve Bannon. And it wouldn't really be dangerous because you'd smell him long before you got there.
Well, I don't want to infight here. My point is you guys weren't working together on January 5th or 6th.
There's no infight. There is no infight. He perjured himself at my trial. He told the House Intelligence Committee under oath that he and I never spoke about WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, or the WikiLeaks data. And he told the grand jury in my trial, the direct opposite. That's called perjury. He will be held to account for
all
it.
All I'm it's saying not, is you weren't in a secret plan with Bannon.
It's not some minor political squabble.
I got it.
It took from seven to nine. So, Alex, men have to choose. You're on one side or you're on the other. It's not where I want to get off here.
No, I hear you. The point is, you were not in a secret conspiracy with Steve Bannon to attack the Capitol.
Now there's an understatement. Here, by the way, is a little historical fact that I think your listeners might need to know. Today is Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday. What people don't know is that upon the murder of King, every politician aspiring to be president headed to Atlanta to get a photo op with Coretta King, Teddy Kennedy, Senator Eugene McCarthy, Bobby Kennedy, Dick Clark, Frank Church, and others. One man asked to see Coretta King privately. That was former President Richard Nixon. He flew to Atlanta and got a private audience with Coretta King, in which he gave her an envelope with a check that paid for the entire college educations of all of her remaining children. He also did not want that information publicly released. Richard Milhouse Nixon. No press, he insisted. He wanted no press. He then marched to the Capitol with Wilt Chamberlain and went to the cemetery where Dr. King was buried. Richard Nixon wasn't looking for political benefit. He had had a very close relationship with Dr. King because the two of them worked closely together against Lyndon Johnson, that great Democrat, to pass the 1958 Civil Rights Act. So today, as remember a great Republican, Dr. Martin Luther King, we should remember that quiet act of empathy and compassion from Richard Nixon.
So that's what Roger Stone had to say. Coming up next is a question posed to Rand Paul by Ingram, Laura Ingram, about these shots where 12-year-old kids can consent themselves to take a vaccine shot. This is what Rand Paul had to say about that.
Senator, I need to get your thoughts on another thing. California is looking to further undermine parents. The first bill out of the California newly formed vaccine caucus would allow children 12 and older to receive vaccinations without their parents' consent. Senator, we know they've wanted to put a wedge between children and their parents for a long time on a lot of issues, but this kind of takes the cake.
I believe it's medical malpractice to force vaccines on children, particularly adolescent males. We now have the scientific evidence that shows the risk of myocarditis for young males is greater for the vaccine than it is for the disease. We also know that the disease, the death rate is closer to 1 in 1 million. We also know that the more you get the vaccine, the higher your risk of myocarditis. So 90% of the myocarditis came with the second vaccine. What do you think it happens when you give them a third vaccine? I think universities like Chicago, Princeton, Yale, that are mandating young males get a third vaccine, I think they're going to be open to liability if any of these boys, these young men or women get myocarditis and, God forbid, dies. They're going to be open to liability because they're going against the science. But you have such left-wing academics whose head are in the sand and just think, oh, Dr. Fauci wants us to do it, we should do it. They're not thinking about this, but they're going to be open to big-time liability for forcing this vaccine on kids.
Senator Paul, as usual, thank you. So important tonight.
Dr. Gerth Vandenbosse, and he has to say about children getting these shots. He says don't give any of the children shots, basically. Here's what he has to say.
It's at the risk of inducing autoimmune responses, autoimmunity in children. That's why I'm saying never, ever use a vaccine that cannot block transmission when you are on the battlefield. If you have a vaccine that cannot prevent the transmission, you cannot control this pandemic. The virus will escape. You cannot win this. It's impossible. So in other words, with this mass vaccination, you're doing exactly the opposite. You are generating a breeding ground for even more infectious variants to replicate. Scientifically, there is no rational whatsoever to vaccinate children. This cannot be justified. There is no added value whatsoever for children. There is only major concerns and major risks. So we know definitely that the risk-benefit ratio is going in a completely wrong direction. So how on earth can you, with that knowledge, can you even think of doing such a thing? I've no other words. This is criminal. And you know, as a scientist, we don't use these words lightly. Well, you hear me saying exactly the opposite, that when you get vaccinated, there is no chance that you can contribute to herd immunity. And my advice is very, very clear. Under no single circumstance should you allow to get your child vaccinated.
Our next clip is an interview with Russell Bentley, and he is living in Donbass and fighting on the side of the Donbass, you could say freedom fighters, which are backed by Russia. He is on the side of Russia. He's being interviewed by Rents. But I'll have this clip on the site where you can listen to the whole thing. Here we go with a short clip of what he says going on in Donbass right now.
I read the other day, as I said, that Putin had ordered the recall, or Lavrov, of all diplomatic staff from Ukraine. Is there any truth to that, first of all, as far as your sources tell you?
Yes, in fact, now it's not all diplomatics, but there has been more than 50 family of diplomats in Ukraine from the Kiev embassy and from two Russian consulates that have been evacuated. It's not, I mean, the diplomats are still working there. The embassy and the consulates are still open, but they have begun evacuating their family members, which, you know, is the first step. You know, I would say that.
That's right. That's right. First step. The,
you know, that'll be if the Kiev embassy does become, you know, if the diplomats evacuate and the embassy gets shut down, you know, that's going to be, you know, that's going to be like the cocking of the hammer on the pistol, and you know it's coming then. You know, it's the, the other thing, too, the OSCE, the, which is like a European supposedly peacekeeping monitoring organization that's here in Donetsk. You know, that's what we've always said, kind of the canary in the coal mine here would be, if the OSCE all of a sudden leaves Donetsk, then, you know, that'll be our sign that, you know, the Ukrainians are getting ready to attack. And, you know, it's such a hair trigger situation here right now. I mean, it's, you know, the Ukrainians are massed along the front line of the Donbass and Luhansk People's Republics. It's about 200 mile front. And there's over 125, maybe 150,000 Ukrainian soldiers on that front, on 200 miles. That's half, I mean, it's literally half of the entire Ukrainian army that's on our front line now. And I'm telling you, where I live in Donetsk, it's about 5 miles, not to the front, but to Ukrainian army bases behind the front on their side. I mean, to the actual front, you know, it's maybe 3 miles. When, you know, I can hear machine guns, I can hear artillery and mortars, you know, in my backyard quite frequently.
Russ, this is amazing. I know where you were before. We did spend a lot of time describing all this. We had pictures, we had everything. You are, for all intents and purposes, you're right at the front line. Okay, you're there. Now, with 125,000 Ukraine troops along the 200-mile border between the Donbass Republic and Western Ukraine, or whatever you want to call it now, that has to be stacked up to the alleged 140,000-145,000 Russian troops that are to the north and spread out, I guess, to Belarus. I don't know where they are exactly, but there's an equal number of troops approximately. Is that correct?
Yeah, there's an equal number of troops, but, you know, the training, the morale, the dedication, and the equipment of the Russian troops, eclipse, the Ukrainians, by orders of magnitude. It is estimated through, the Ukrainian military has done some, in the last year, has done several internal surveys, where they go to, military units and they give out these anonymous, surveys for them to fill out, for the actual soldiers to fill out. And it comes back that 80% of them say they won't even fight, They won't shoot against Donbass. They won't fight if the Russians come in to liberate Ukraine. So the majority of Ukrainian soldiers don't even want to fight. There's 20% that are, these neo-Nazi battalions like Pravi Sector and Azov and Idar and,
Azov is still there. Genuine. Okay. I remember Azov. Yeah.
The Nazis don't, the Nazis will fight. There's really not a lot of people in the West know this, but there's a lot of ISIS terrorists that came from Syria, that came from Iraq, and that are here now fighting alongside the Ukrainian army.
Well, they were there when we were talking 5-6 years ago. They were in Odessa. They were, the hell were they? They were coming in. I remember this.
And they still have been, and, there's a lot of them here, and these are, very dangerous dudes. They're, very combat experienced. They're totally ruthless and merciless and a very dangerous enemy.
Yeah.
Go ahead. There's also a bunch of the war criminals. Russia and Donbass republics have been, documenting every war crime that's been done by the Ukrainian army in this war. And we know, who's the general that ordered to bomb the school? Who's the colonel that bombed the hospital? We have all this documented. And when we do liberate Ukraine, those guys are going on trial, and they'll probably spend the rest of their lives repairing all the damage that they've done. So those guys, Nazis, the ISIS, the war criminals, these guys will fight, but that's only about 20%. And the most important thing to understand, it's not a Russian invasion, it's a Russian liberation of the occupation by the United States and the collaborator, Nazi collaborator governments.
I've been using that word. Now, it is, it's a liberate Ukraine. It's exactly what I've said, and I'm very glad to hear you repeat it. I hope the morale in Donbass Republic and the Lugansk Republic, I hope the morale is up. The world, the intelligent part of the world, is on your side. They understand what's going on. I wouldn't say the rank and file sheep understand it, but those who are informed truly understand. Ukraine needs to be flushed. It's like a toilet that's running over. It's got to be cleaned. It's got to be restored. And there's only one way that can happen. And I've heard that if Putin gives the go, Ukraine might last 6 days. That's it. The Russian military will roll right through it. How do you think?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. I mean, it'll be like it'll be like Georgia back in 2008, when Saakashvili attacked South Ossetia. It'll be a weekend affair and lunch in Kiev on Monday.
Well, I'm in favor of it. I imagine most everyone in the East is also in favor of it, and probably a lot of people who live in Ukraine who are sick and tired of this the looting of their country, the looting of their culture. It's all been, this country has been destroyed from what you're telling us. This is sickening.
Yep. And, it is an existential security threat to the Russian Federation to have, a mad dog failed country right literally on their border, one that's controlled by NATO and the United States, which are, real enemies of Russia, who've, tried every single thing they could to, disrupt Russia's development. Russia obeys international law. You can't say, that, Russia has 700 military bases around the world. You can't say that Russia has attacked, a dozen different countries in the last three decades, you know, and basically destroyed them, you know, bringing democracy and yet completely destroying them. I mean, you look at Yugoslavia, you know, you look at Iraq, you look at Afghanistan, you look at, you know, Libya, you know, you look at Ukraine. All these places have been destroyed by U.S. and NATO intervention, you know, and it hasn't done the people there any good at all. And in fact,
no.
You know, destroyed their quality of life and, you know, increased their suffering, you know, by orders of magnitude. So, you know, Russia's, you know, really is the good guy here, and the U.S., you know, simply is not.
I'm so glad you're on again and we're able to talk about this and present reality like we did in the past. This is crucial information, and right now there are a lot of people listening. There will be a lot passing this program around. Here we are at the absolute ugliest part of the decimation of Ukraine. I don't know how much worse it can get. I'm not there. But what I'm hearing from you is that the sentiment among the people in Donbass Republic and Luhansk Republic and Crimea is absolutely resolute. They are not going to allow this to be reversed under any circumstances. Fair statement?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, first of all, you know, we don't have anywhere to retreat to. Like I said,
right.
The front line
right.
is basically the city limits.
Yeah.
You know, there's nothing behind us but our homes and our families. You know, it'll be like the Alamo. If the Ukrainians come in here to attack, assault the Donbass People's Republic or the Luhansk People's Republic, you know, we'll fight to the last man and the last bullet. And that is no exaggeration, and it's not rhetoric. It's actually what we're going to do. It's basically what we've been doing, you know, this whole time, almost 8 years now. You know, the guys at the front, you know, they're protecting their own homes, you know. I mean, not only that, but the people of Donbass, this area of Ukraine and Russia, the Don River Basin, you know, these are you know, legendary people for 1,000 years. They used to be called the Scythians, you know, back in the Bible times, you know.
Yes, I've heard the name.
Ever since, they're indigenous people that have never really been defeated. You know, they're hard working. This is coal mining area, you know, so the men here are real tough. You know, they've been through, like my godfather, he's a Orthodox priest, you know, and my wife asked him once why there's so many miracles that happen in this part of the world. And he said, because this part of the world has been flooded with blood over the years, over the centuries. And I mean, this was, a main part of the Soviet Bolshevik Revolution. It was the center of the Russian Civil War after the revolution. You know, this was part of the Soviet Union that was occupied by the German Nazis in the Second World War. And, you know, the people here, you know, they're smart, they're tough, they're friendly, they're hardworking, you know, they're very generous. But, you know, if you come here with a weapon, you will die here, you know, and that's the way that it's always been here. I mean, this is like the area of Cossacks, you know, so it's like Russian cowboys. And they don't, you know, they don't take any BS off of anybody.
I remember when we spent all those programs together in the past, I don't know how many, there were a lot of them, and you showed some video once of Christmas in downtown Donetsk, I guess. Where was it? It was Christmas.
In
it
the
was
center
beautiful.
Of downtown Donetsk. We just made another video with Christmas this year, too. They make a huge Christmas tree, and, like, everybody comes out, and they have, like, concerts. And I mean, there's thousands of people there. I mean, this is, you know, Russia and Donbass, you know, these are Christian nations. You know, it's Russian Orthodox Christianity, which I am a convert to. And, you know, it's like, you know, as a Christian, you know, I see, you know, all this, you know, disgusting stuff that happens in the Catholic Church with these pedophiles and,
God, that's not a church. It's organized pedophilia. I know it. Everybody knows it out here now. Yeah.
And then the thing is with the Protestant religion, like me, you know, growing up in Texas in the South, you know, they have these, mega churches, you know, and it's like a football stadium. And basically, you know, I mean, and these preachers that, you know, are multi-millionaires. They got private jets, you know, diamond encrusted Rolex watches. And that ain't the way that Jesus.
They're fraud. They're criminal frauds, Russ. They're criminal frauds. And everybody with a brain knows it. They're disgusting people. I couldn't
agree
more with you.
They worship money.
Oh, yeah, that's
and, you know,
their, well,
in the Bible,
that and Satan, yeah.
You know, in the Bible, there's a quote from the Bible that a lot of people get wrong, you know, and they say, oh, money is the root of all evil. And that's not the Bible quote. The Bible quote correctly is the love of money is the root of all evil.
Yeah, there you go.
And these mega churches, that's all they do. They preach the love of money. They preach to rich people and say, oh, God is rewarding you because you're rich, because you're good, and they're punishing the poor people because they're poor, because they're bad, so you don't have to worry about the poor people. And the richer you are, the better you are. And that's exactly the opposite of what Christ taught. And here in Donbass and in Russia, the Russian Orthodox religion, I mean, to me, it's like still the real Christianity based on the teachings of Jesus Christ. You know, I mean, my godfather is an Orthodox priest. I have two very good friends. One's a Orthodox priest, one's a Orthodox monk. You know, and these guys, you know, they walk the walk. They live it, you know, as their principles.
I'm going to finish up a production, and I want you to listen to this carefully. It's about confluencing, consolidation of all these accounting methods, of these stakeholder methods into a world system. So this is all consolidation into an international world system of rule, actually. That's what World Economic Forum has been pushing, public-private partnerships. I'm just going to go to the end of our exit music here, but I'll have a clip off where you can listen to the whole. But I want you to be cautioned. This is not what I'm pushing, but you need to understand what the World Economic Forum is really all about, and that's corporate fascist. That's what they're pushing. Here we go now.
Hello and welcome to Stakeholder Capitalism, a show by the World Economic Forum exploring how economies can be made to work for progress, people, and the planet. I'm Natalie Pierce.
And I'm Peter Fanham. If you've been following us along, you know that in each episode, we've been looking at the current mode of capitalism and all its angles.
We've been joined by experts around the world who have helped us diagnose the problems and prescribe possible solutions.
But now in our final episode, we'll go beyond analysis and theories and get into the nitty-gritty. We'll look at how we can implement stakeholder capitalism and what that would look like on the ground in companies.
Let's get started. To kick today's episode off, we are joined first by Emily Bailey. Emily is the project lead of the World Economic Forum's ESG initiative, and there is no one better to talk to about stakeholder capitalism and how we measure and implement it than Emily. Thanks for being with us today, Emily.
Great to be here, Natalie.
Let's start with the basics. What are ESG metrics, and why do they matter for stakeholder capitalism?
So ESG metrics are environmental, social, and governance issues. So things like GHG emissions, pay equality, anti-corruption efforts. It's becoming increasingly important alongside the reporting they do on things like their finances and their financial accounting.
And why do you think now, in today's current context, more important now than ever?
There's no international standard right now for ESG and non-financial reporting. So this initiative came about because a group of companies said, can we actually, as a group of companies across different industries, different geographies, different capabilities of ESG reporting, come together, agree on a basic set of ESG metrics and disclosures that we can all start reporting on? This initiative has been going on at the forum for 2 years now, working with over 100 companies, over 50 who've already integrated the metrics into their reporting materials. So what the companies who are joining the Stakeholder Capitalism Metrics Initiative are committing to are including the metrics either in their annual report or their sustainability report. And they do this on a voluntary effort. One company may not take on board all the metrics because not all of those metrics are material to their business. Take, for example, a bank. A bank might not need to report on water consumption because water consumption is not material to their business. The second element is they commit to working with the forum and the coalition of companies on actually helping to push for this global alignment and global convergence. And then the third element is actually working across their networks of their peers, their competitors, companies in their supply chain to actually encourage them to take this on board and join this effort as well.
People also say in management that what gets measured also gets managed. Mm-hmm. So does that play into why companies and managers, CEOs, are increasingly acting on this ESG report?
Absolutely. So it helps them to also bring their entire organizations on board. It's not just the sustainability team or the finance team that does the reporting. You need your human capital and kind of HR teams on board. You need your operations teams on board. You need every aspect of your business on board.
So you see these ESG metrics, let's say, trickle down from the top of a company to, you know, various divisions of the company.
Trickle up and trickle down, because you also have employees demanding that their companies are taking on board these initiatives. They want to see that a company is ESG friendly, is ESG mindful, and is actually delivering on what they say they're doing. So it's coming from the bottom, and it's also coming from the top.
Which of the indicators are kind of significant KPIs?
We did a very open consultation process to actually set on the metrics that we use now with investors, companies, academics, NGOs, data providers, stock exchanges, kind of the whole ecosystem of the producers and users of this information. It coincided with the spread of the COVID-19 across the world. At the start of the consultation, we felt a strong emphasis on the importance of the climate crisis and the climate emergency. But as we continued on in the process, the importance of the S metrics, so like the pay equality metrics, the workplace health and safety measures, those were becoming increasingly important because everyone wanted to know in the crisis what were companies doing to protect their workforce, what were companies doing to protect their supply chain, what were companies doing to actually make sure that they were, you know, being safe operators and safe citizens in a very complex period. All elements of ESG for us are important and urgent, but the COVID pandemic really highlighted that we need to have better reporting on the S metrics.
Things like inequality, pay equity, these are very telling metrics that could also open a company up to some level of vulnerability when they share these.
So this whole effort is voluntary. Other jurisdictions are considering what kind of mandatory reporting requirements they pursue in the near term to increase a company's obligation to report on their ESG performance. So if companies are starting now and doing it on a voluntary basis, you can start to work out the kinks in the system. But in the interim, even right now, companies are finding it helpful because they're being asked by suppliers to be compliant with our compliance process, to be part of our supply chain. You have to tell us all these ESG performance metrics. Their financial institutions are saying, well, we can only give you the funding for this and the capital for this if you do ESG performance across these metrics. They need to have good ESG metrics and information at hand and have the reporting up to a certain level, because otherwise they will not be able to operate in the global ecosystem.
Critics of stakeholder capitalism have pointed out to the idea that this is mostly for show. The companies commit to stakeholders for show, it's not for real. To what extent is the initiative that you're leading on stakeholder capitalism metrics a response to those critics?
Sure. So we started this initiative 2 years ago working with the Big Four audit and accounting firms because we wanted to have the right rigor and technical expertise to actually make sure that the outputs of our initiative were auditable. We actually wanted to leverage what currently exists in the marketplace to demonstrate that the current metrics and disclosures from institutions like GRI, SASB, and TCFD really actually can underpin what can move us towards a global solution for ESG and non-financial reporting. So this whole effort is voluntary. But it's really companies saying and looking at our metrics as a toolkit to actually start to demonstrate their commitment to long-term value creation, to demonstrate their commitment to stakeholder capitalism.
Thank you, Emily.
Our next guest is Jonas Prising. He's the CEO of Manpower Group, one of the largest workforce solutions companies in the world, also a Fortune 500 company. And he's joining us today to talk about why he joined the stakeholder capitalism metrics. Welcome, Jonas.
Thank you, Peter. Delighted to be here.
Jonas, you are one of the largest workforce solutions companies in the world. To get a sense of just how big the company is, could you tell us how many people you employ every day?
We employ more than 500,000 people across our 75 countries where we operate globally, Peter. So we have a very large footprint and lots of people that we employ during the course of the year. Approximately 2.5 million people come into contact with us and work with us on various assignments across our various brands.
You are one of the companies also that signed up for the stakeholder capitalism metrics of the World Economic Forum. Why was it important for you to do so?
As Manpower Group is so actively involved in these labor markets with such big volumes, we can clearly see the effect of the bifurcation of the labor markets between the haves and the have-nots and those who have skills that can participate and look ahead to a bright future, and those that are clearly struggling in unskilled or lower skilled jobs that are changing significantly due to technological evolution, globalization, changing ways of operating within organizations, and also their own preferences. So we think it's very important to help bridge this gap that we see continuing after the pandemic and actually accelerating after the pandemic.
Can you give us some examples of the key stakeholder capitalism metrics that you monitor and measure?
So the area where we think we can have a significant impact is helping bridge the gap, essentially bringing talent pools in that are disproportionately underrepresented in the workforce, in our workforce, and making sure that they have the opportunities to participate. So the metrics that we use here at Manpower Group are gender representation across the company, but in particular at leadership levels, and that includes our board of directors, making sure that we have secondary targets in different countries. So here in the U.S., for instance, people of color representation across the company and at leadership levels is very important. So those are some of the metrics that we use as it relates to making sure that we keep track of the targets that we have and how we can make progress under the S of ESG.
What have been the moments of progress where you felt like this is really working? Have you seen improvement in these areas since you've implemented the metrics?
When we started, our senior leadership representation for women was 22%. And very quickly, we made progress, and last year we met 38% representation at the senior leadership level, and I project we'll get to our target of 40% in 2022. So now we're resetting our leadership representation target to 50% so that we can continue to make progress. But I have to say, setting targets is not enough. When we started our progress around gender representation at leadership levels and how important it was, we clearly had a clear idea that it's the right thing to do, and yet we didn't see much traction on making progress on this objective. But when we started to tackle this as a business strategy that was being led from the top and started measuring our progress and ensuring that our people were acting in accordance with it, that's when we saw the progress. I really came to the conclusion that it has to do with the sincerity and the commitment of leadership itself, and first and foremost, the CEO.
Jonas, you know, of course, that also means that if you say the importance of leadership may also mean that it's important to have different skills as a leader of a company or as a management team. What are the new skills that you think are required by leaders of companies?
So the first part, of course, is to ensuring that everyone is aligned strategically, that we all know, understand, believe, and act in accordance with our targets and our values. Because the stakeholder view is that we are here not only to run a very successful business, but also to ensure that we contribute to the well-being of the communities in which we operate. I think it's very important to think about this as a business strategy. You have to think about this as a way of enabling and accessing talent that's going to help you become much more diverse in your thinking, which is extremely useful as you're trying to navigate a rapidly changing and disruptive world.
Let's zoom out for a second. What is the ultimate goal of these stakeholder capitalism metrics, and what's the kind of world that you are contributing to or that you are hoping to see will emerge from companies adopting them?
I think most people, most organizations realize that what we have around climate is not sustainable and that we really need to drive towards a more environmentally sustainable planet. We feel that it is not truly the same situation yet on the S in ESG. So the social aspects are as yet underrepresented, underweighted, both from an institutional perspective and from an organizational perspective. But from what we can see, the gaps in the labor markets are real. We may all have been in the same storm during the pandemic, but we clearly were not in the same boat. So different categories of workers experienced the pandemic in very different ways. And frankly, many workers had an extremely tough time and continue to have a difficult time during the post-pandemic or the latter parts of the pandemic. So making them feel that there is a future, that they have an ability to participate for the future of themselves, their children, and their friends is going to be vital so that we don't create big fissures in the labor markets, which ultimately become big fissures in the country and the societal fabric of each nation. We think that the defining challenge of our time is to bridge these gaps and to build meaningful and sustainable employment for all. And that is the role that we intend to play and be part of a solution to bridge those gaps, which we think otherwise could become very, very difficult for many people to navigate.
Fair enough. Fewer storms and better ships for all is how I would summarize that. Thank you so much, Jonas, for your time with us.
Thank you so much, Pierre and Natalie.
Our next guest is Geraldine Matchett. She is the CFO and the co-CEO of Royal DSM, a Dutch multinational company that is a leader on stakeholder capitalism. It's a company active in many different markets, including health, nutrition, and bioscience, and posts almost $10 billion in global sales. Welcome, Geraldine.
Hello.
Geraldine, I was hoping we could start our conversation really with the basics. Peter told us a little bit about Royal DSM. What do you do, and particularly, what's kind of your scope and scale?
As Royal DSM, we're the world leaders in what makes food actually nutritious, both for humans and for animals. It's a lot of science in not only the making, but also in understanding how bodies work. We are very much a leader in biosciences. We still have an activity in specialty materials that go into cars and mobile phones. That's only about 15% of DSM today.
Geraldine, you know, one of the things that strikes me is that DSM used to be known as the Dutch State Mines, a company founded very much in the big era of coal. Today, your company is about something entirely different. Could you tell us a little more about that transition and how you achieved that?
The company was founded in 1902 and used to stand for Dutch State Mines. So we used to run and own the coal of the country. And then over time, there was a clear view that this was not going to be the future. And we evolved. We evolved much more into chemistry, actually a little bit into petrochemical refining. And again, with a bit of foresight, really looking forward, thinking, this is probably not going to be the best place. We transitioned and developed our skill sets in science.